People of a certain age may remember the old ad line, when E.F. Hutton speaks, people listen. Well, for those in my line of work, when Peter J. Gomes spoke, people listen. Some of you may recall that I've spoken about Peter before. He was my homiletics professor at Divinity School, and he had a tremendous impact on my classmates and me. He had a list of credentials that was like a preaching rap sheet. He gave the invocation at two presidential inaugurations. He was the Plummer Professor of Christian Morals and Pusey Minister at the Memorial Church. He authored a number of best-selling books about the Bible and about preaching. And the fact is that he could read the phone book and you'd want to listen to him. So when Peter made observations about the preacher's art, we listened carefully. One thing he said that has always stuck with me all these years is that preaching is like flying an airplane. We take off, we reach cruising altitude, head towards our destination, and then we come in for a landing. Now, those who know anything about flying know that it is the landing that is the most difficult part of the enterprise. If you mistime things, if you're off your game, if there's a headwind, you can crash. And that happens to preachers. The sermon can come to an awful, ugly end. It may provide wonderful conversation fodder for the congregation for years to come, but the preacher will feel bad. So preachers try to avoid crashing the sermon into the ground. But there is another more subtle danger, one that more often ensnares those giving sermons. That is the aborted landing. The plane is coming in. The landing gear's been deployed. You can see the tarmac. And then at the last minute, the pilot pulls back on the stick, the nose goes up, and a new homily is added to the sermon. I hope you like the way I mix these metaphors. The best of preachers can fall prey to this temptation. Indeed, even the people who edited the Gospels fell prey to this seduction. If you look at John's Gospel, you'll notice there are 21 chapters. That last chapter, the one that immediately followed on today's lesson, was added on at a later date. The Gospel, according to John, should have ended with the verses that Linda read for us a few moments ago. Now, we can't be sure why these additional verses, which depict a series of post-resurrection meetings of Jesus with others, were added to the scripture. Perhaps people in the early church felt they needed to provide more examples of the risen Lord so people would believe in the resurrection. But if the final verses of scripture, if the final lines in a story are meant to be a summation, a conclusion, a climax, if they're meant to be the point to which everything is driving, what then would these final verses in John chapter 20 be trying to tell us? I think over the years the message has been obscured a bit. Partly because of the addition of chapter 21, people have read the end of chapter 20 and focused on doubting Thomas. Poor Thomas. He is the only disciple who winds up with an appellation. The only one with a derisive nickname. Peter gets to be the rock. Yet this is the same person who denied Jesus 3 times. But we don't call him wobbly Peter, do we? We don't call him denying Peter. No, he's just Peter. But Thomas walks around doubting for 2,000 years. Doubting, doubting, doubting. It's meant to be a criticism when we call him that. And yet I don't think it's intended. Remember what happens. Jesus appears to the disciples who are gathered in a room, and he performs signs and miracles. Thomas isn't present. So the disciples tell him what has happened. And remember, these are the disciples who are always spending time arguing about who's going to be the first and who's most important. You can imagine maybe there's a little tension there in their words. Yes, they're excited about the resurrection, but also maybe there's a little latent pride. Hey, we were there, Thomas. We saw it. And his reaction is, thanks, I need to see for myself. So, of course, Jesus obliges. Thomas touches him. He offers his declaration, my Lord, my God. Jesus observes, you believe because you saw. Imagine how blessed those who haven't seen will be. And then the gospel ends with the observation that Jesus performed more miracles, more acts for the disciples. They're not recorded here, but they happen. Believe it, it's true. And they're done so that those who believe can receive the kingdom. Think about what happens between Thomas and Jesus. Thomas has questions. Thomas is skeptical. Thomas is using his faculties of inquiry that were given to him by whom? God. We're meant to ask questions about the world around us, to wonder what's going on. And when he does that, does Jesus say to him, sorry, Thomas, you should have been here last week. You missed your chance. Does he say, hey, I am the risen Lord. I don't have any points to make to you. I don't have to prove anything to you. No. What Thomas does prompts an action from Jesus that is meant to meet Thomas where he is. Remember, Jesus just shows up knowing what Thomas needs. He says, touch me. He offers an invitation. And Thomas, wanting to believe, risks touching Jesus. And he declares, my Lord and my God. Now, John's gospel, more so than the other gospels, makes the point again and again and again about the divine nature of Jesus, how Jesus is God. And it is left to Thomas, not Peter, not Mary, not Andrew or James or any of the other disciples. It's left to Thomas to give voice to this truth. He is the first person after the resurrection to say Jesus is God. This is a big deal. The gospel has been leading to this point and to this affirmation. Think about how Matthew's gospel ends. Jesus gives the disciples the great commission to go out and to share the news with the people of all the world. Well, here John wants to stress, Jesus is Lord and God. And those who believe in him are going to share in the new creation. Jesus' words to Thomas, his observation about you saw, you believe, imagine how blessed those who don't will be, isn't meant as a criticism. If it were, he'd also be criticizing the other disciples. They got to see things too. It's a statement of fact, plain and simple. Those who don't see are going to be blessed even more. And why is it important to include these words in the gospel? Well, think about when it was written. Probably around the year 90 or 100. The temple has been destroyed. Those who follow Jesus have separated from the synagogue. The Romans are still persecuting and denigrating this new community. There are people who are wondering, is it worth it? We're not getting any visitations. No one's showing up to let us touch them on the side. And so John shares Jesus' words, a word that is meant for the people of John's day and also for ours. That's right, these words are meant for all of you and for me. We are blessed because we believe, even if we haven't seen. And maybe our belief varies in its intensity or its certitude. Jesus is willing to keep coming to us. He will keep meeting us. The resurrection happens once, but its impact, its effect is ongoing. This is the good news of John's gospel. And I believe that this was meant to be the last word. Not a rebuke, not a criticism. It was meant to be an exhortation and an encouragement, a word of hope, which is oh so appropriate in the wake of Easter.